Chapter 11. Anschluss. The Rape of Austria. Toward the end of 1937, due to a change of jobs from newspaper to radio reporting, my headquarters were transferred from Berlin to Vienna, which I had come to know as a youthful correspondent a decade before. Though I would spend most of the period of the next three crucial years in Germany, my new assignment, which was to cover continental Europe, gave me a certain perspective of the Third Reich and, as it happened, set me down in those very neighboring countries which were to be victims of Hitler's aggression just prior to and during the time the aggression took place. I roved back and forth in those days between Germany and the country that for the moment was the object of Hitler's fury, and so gathered a first-hand experience of the events which are now to be described, and which led inexorably to the greatest and bloodiest war in man's experience. Though we observed these happenings at first hand, it is amazing how little we really knew of how they came about. The plottings and maneuvers, the treachery, the fateful decisions and moments of indecision, and the dramatic encounters of the principal participants which shaped the course of events, took place in secret beneath the surface, hidden from the prying eyes of foreign diplomats, journalists, and spies, and thus for years remained largely unknown to all but a few who took part in them. We have had to wait for the maze of secret documents and the testimony of the surviving leading actors in the drama, most of whom were not free at the time, many landed in Nazi concentration camps, to tell their story. What follows, therefore, in the ensuing pages is based largely on the mass of factual evidence which has been accumulated since 1945. But it was perhaps helpful for a narrator of such a history as this to have been personally present at its main crises and turning points. Thus, it happened that I was in Vienna on the memorable night of March 11th to 12th, 1938, when Austria ceased to exist. For more than a month, the beautiful Baroque capital by the Danube, whose inhabitants were more attractive, more genial, more gifted in enjoying life such as it was than any people I had ever known, had been prey to deep anxieties. Dr. Kurt von Schuschnigg, the Austrian Chancellor, would later recall the period between February 12th and March 11th as the 4 weeks' agony. Since the Austro-German agreement of July 11th, 1936, in which Schuschnigg, in a secret annex to the treaty, had made far-reaching concessions to the Austrian Nazis, Franz von Papen, Hitler's special ambassador in Vienna, had been continuing his labors to undermine the independence of Austria and bring about its union with Nazi Germany. In a long report to the Führer at the end of 1936, he had reported on his progress, and a year later had done the same, this time stressing that only by subjecting the federal chancellor, Schuschnigg, to the strongest possible pressure can further progress be made. His advice, though scarcely needed, was soon to be taken more literally than even he could conceive. Throughout 1937, the Austrian Nazis, financed and egged on by Berlin, had stepped up their campaign of terror. Bombings took place nearly every day in some part of the country, and in the mountain provinces, massive and often violent Nazi demonstrations weakened the government's position. Plans were uncovered disclosing that Nazi thugs were preparing to bump off Schuschnigg as they had his predecessor. Finally, on January 25, 1938, Austrian police raided the Vienna headquarters of a group called the Committee of Seven, which had been set up to bring about peace between the Nazis and the Austrian government, but which in reality served as the central office of the illegal Nazi underground. There they found documents initialed by Rudolf Hess, the Führer's deputy, which made it clear that the Austrian Nazis were to stage an open revolt in the spring of 1938, and that when Schuschnigg attempted to put it down, the German army would enter Austria to prevent German blood from being shed by Germans. According to Papen, one of the documents called for his own murder or that of his military attaché, Lieutenant General Muff, by local Nazis, so as to provide an excuse for German intervention. If the debonair Papen was less than amused to learn that he was marked, for the second time, for assassination by Nazi roughnecks on orders from party leaders in Berlin, he was also distressed by a telephone call which came to him at the German legation in Vienna on the evening of February 4th. State Secretary Hans Lammers was on the line from the Chancellery in Berlin to inform him that his special mission in Austria had ended. He had been fired, along with Neurath, Fritsch, and several others. "I was almost speechless with astonishment," Papen later remembered. He recovered sufficiently to realize that Hitler evidently had decided on more drastic action in Austria, now that he had rid himself of Neurath, Fritsch, and Blomberg. In fact, Papen recovered sufficiently to decide to do something unusual for a diplomat, as he put it. He resolved to deposit copies of all his correspondence with Hitler in a safe place, which turned out to be Switzerland. "The defamatory campaigns of the Third Reich," he says, "were only too well known to me." As we have seen, they had almost cost him his life in June 1934. Papen's dismissal was also a warning to Schuschnigg. He had not fully trusted the suave former cavalry officer, but he was quick to see that Hitler must have something worse in mind than inflicting on him the wily ambassador, who at least was a devout Catholic, as was he, and a gentleman. In the last few months, the course of European diplomacy had not favored Austria. Mussolini had drawn closer to Hitler since the establishment of the Rome-Berlin axis, and was not so concerned about maintaining the little country's independence as he had been at the time of the murder of Dollfuss, when he had rushed four divisions to the Brenner Pass to frighten the Führer. Neither Britain, freshly embarked under Chamberlain upon a policy of appeasing Hitler, nor France, beset by grave internal political strife, had recently shown much interest in defending Austria's independence should Hitler strike. And now, with Papen, had gone the conservative leaders of the German army and foreign office, who had exercised some restraining influence on Hitler's towering ambitions. Schuschnigg, who was a narrow-minded man but within his limits an intelligent one, and who was quite well informed, had few illusions about his worsening situation. The time had come, as he felt it had come after the Nazis slew Dollfuss, to further appease the German dictator. Papen, discharged from office though he was, offered an opportunity. Never a man to resent a slap in the face if it came from above, he had hurried to Hitler the very day after his dismissal to obtain some picture of what was going on. At Berchtesgaden on February 5th, he found the Führer exhausted and distraught from his struggle with the generals. But Hitler's recuperative powers were considerable, and soon the cashiered envoy was interesting him in a proposal that he had already broached to him a fortnight before when they had met in Berlin. Why not have it out with Schuschnigg personally? Why not invite him to come to Berchtesgaden for a personal talk? Hitler found the idea interesting. Unmindful of the fact that he had just fired Papen, he ordered him to return to Vienna and arrange the meeting. Schuschnigg readily assented to it, but, weak as his position was, laid down certain conditions. He must be informed in advance of the precise points which Hitler wanted to discuss, and he must be assured beforehand that the agreement of July 11, 1936, in which Germany promised to respect Austria's independence and not to interfere in her internal affairs, would be maintained. Furthermore, the communiqué at the end of the meeting must reaffirm that both countries would continue to abide by the 1936 treaty. Schuschnigg wanted to take no chances in bearding the lion in his den. Papen hurried off to Obersalzberg to confer with Hitler and returned with the Führer's assurance that the 1936 agreement would remain unchanged, and that he merely wanted to discuss such misunderstandings and points of friction as have persisted since it was signed. This was not as precise as the Austrian Chancellor had requested, but he said he was satisfied with the answer. The meeting was set for the morning of February 12th, which happened to be the fourth anniversary of the slaughter of the Austrian Social Democrats by the Dollfuss government, of which Schuschnigg was a member. On February 12, 1934, 17,000 government troops and fascist militia had turned artillery on the workers' flats in Vienna, killing 1,000 men, women, and children, and wounding 3,000 or 4,000 more. Democratic political freedom was stamped out, and Austria thereafter was ruled first by Dollfuss, and then by Schuschnigg as a clerical fascist dictatorship. It was certainly milder than the Nazi variety, as those of us who worked in both Berlin and Vienna in those days can testify. Nevertheless, it deprived the Austrian people of their political freedom, and subjected them to more repression than they had known under the Habsburgs in the last decades of the monarchy. The author has discussed this more fully in Mid-Century Journey. And on the evening of February 11th, Schuschnigg, accompanied by his Undersecretary for Foreign Affairs, Guido Schmidt, set off by special train in the strictest secrecy for Salzburg, whence he would drive by car over the border to Hitler's mountain retreat on the following morning. It was to prove a fateful journey. The Meeting at Berchtesgaden, February 12, 1938. Papen showed up at the frontier to greet his Austrian visitors, and in the frosty winter morning air seemed to be, Schuschnigg thought, in the very best of humor. Hitler, he assured his guests, was in an excellent mood this day. And then came the first warning note. The Führer, Papen said genially, hoped Dr. Schuschnigg would not mind the presence at the Berghof of three generals who had arrived quite by chance. Keitel, the new chief of OKW, Reichenau, who commanded the army forces on the Bavarian-Austrian frontier, and Sperle, who was in charge of the air force in this area. Papen later remembered of his guests that this was a piece of information that seemed little to their taste. Schuschnigg says he told the ambassador he would not mind, especially since he had not much choice in the matter. A Jesuit-trained intellectual, he was getting on his guard. Even so, he was not prepared for what now took place. Hitler, wearing the brown tunic of a stormtrooper, with black trousers, and flanked by the three generals, greeted the Austrian chancellor and his aide on the steps of the villa. Schuschnigg felt it was a friendly but formal greeting. In a few moments he found himself alone with the German dictator in the spacious second-floor study, whose great picture windows looked out upon the stately snow-capped Alps, and on Austria, the birthplace of both these men, beyond. Kurt von Schuschnigg, 41 years old, was, as all who have known him would agree, a man of impeccable old-world Austrian manners. And it was not unnatural for him to begin the conversation with a graceful tidbit about the magnificent view, the fine weather that day, and a flattering word about this room having been, no doubt, the scene of many decisive conferences. Hitler cut him short. "We did not gather here to speak of the fine view or of the weather." Then the storm broke. As the Austrian chancellor later testified, the ensuing two-hour conversation was somewhat unilateral. Later, Dr. Schuschnigg wrote down from memory an account of what he calls the significant passages of the one-sided conversation, and though it is therefore not a verbatim record, it rings true to anyone who has heard and studied Hitler's countless utterances, and its substance is verified not only by all that happened subsequently, but by others who were present at the Berghof that day, notably Papen, Jodl, and Guido Schmidt. I have followed Schuschnigg's account, given in his book Austrian Requiem, and in his Nuremberg affidavit on the meeting. "You have done everything to avoid a friendly policy," Hitler fumed. "The whole history of Austria is just one uninterrupted act of high treason. That was so in the past and is no better today. This historical paradox must now reach its long overdue end, and I can tell you right now, Herr Schuschnigg, that I am absolutely determined to make an end of all this. The German Reich is one of the great powers, and nobody will raise his voice if it settles its border problems." Shocked at Hitler's outburst, the quiet-mannered Austrian chancellor tried to remain conciliatory and yet stand his ground. He said he differed from his host on the question of Austria's role in German history. "Austria's contribution in this respect," he maintained, "is considerable." Hitler: "Absolutely zero. I'm telling you, absolutely zero. Every national idea was sabotaged by Austria throughout history. And indeed, all this sabotage was the chief activity of the Habsburgs and the Catholic Church." It is evident that Hitler's warped version of Austro-German history, which, as we have seen in earlier chapters, was picked up in his youth at Linz and Vienna, remained unchanged. Schuschnigg: "All the same, Herr Reichskanzler, many an Austrian contribution cannot possibly be separated from the general picture of German culture. Take, for instance, a man like Beethoven." Hitler: "Oh, Beethoven? Let me tell you that Beethoven came from the Lower Rhineland." Schuschnigg: "Yet Austria was the country of his choice, as it was for so many others." Hitler: "That's as may be. I am telling you once more that things cannot go on in this way. I have a historic mission, and this mission I will fulfill, because Providence has destined me to do so. Who is not with me will be crushed. I have chosen the most difficult road that any German ever took. I have made the greatest achievement in the history of Germany, greater than any other German. And not by force, mind you. I am carried along by the love of my people." Schuschnigg: "Herr Reichskanzler, I am quite willing to believe that." After an hour of this, Schuschnigg asked his antagonist to enumerate his complaints. "We will do everything," he said, "to remove obstacles to a better understanding, as far as it is possible." Hitler: "That is what you say, Herr Schuschnigg, but I am telling you that I am going to solve the so-called Austrian problem one way or the other." He then launched into a tirade against Austria for fortifying its border against Germany, a charge that Schuschnigg denied. Hitler: "Listen, you don't really think you can move a single stone in Austria without my hearing about it the next day, do you? I have only to give an order, and in one single night all your ridiculous defense mechanisms will be blown to bits. You don't seriously believe that you can stop me for half an hour, do you? I would very much like to save Austria from such a fate, because such an action would mean blood. After the army, my SA and Austrian Legion would move in, and nobody can stop their just revenge, not even I." After these threats, Hitler reminded Schuschnigg, rudely addressing him always by his name instead of by his title, as diplomatic courtesy called for, of Austria's isolation and consequent helplessness. Hitler: "Don't think for one moment that anybody on earth is going to thwart my decisions. Italy? I see eye to eye with Mussolini. England? England will not move one finger for Austria. And France?" "France," he said, "could have stopped Germany in the Rhineland, and then we would have had to retreat, but now it is too late for France." Finally, Hitler: "I give you once more, and for the last time, the opportunity to come to terms, Herr Schuschnigg. Either we find a solution now, or else events will take their course. Think it over, Herr Schuschnigg. Think it over well. I can only wait until this afternoon." "What exactly were the German Chancellor's terms?" Schuschnigg asked. "We can discuss that this afternoon," Hitler said. During lunch, Hitler appeared to be, Schuschnigg observed somewhat to his surprise, in excellent spirits. His monologue dwelt on horses and houses. He was going to build the greatest skyscrapers the world had ever seen. "The Americans will see," he remarked to Schuschnigg, "that Germany is building bigger and better buildings than the United States." As for the harried Austrian chancellor, Papen noted that he appeared worried and preoccupied. A chain cigarette smoker, he had not been allowed to smoke in Hitler's presence. But after coffee in an adjoining room, Hitler excused himself, and Schuschnigg was able for the first time to snatch a smoke. He was also able to tell his foreign undersecretary, Guido Schmidt, the bad news. It was soon to grow worse. After cooling their heels for 2 hours in a small anteroom, the two Austrians were ushered into the presence of Ribbentrop, the new German foreign minister, and of Papen. Ribbentrop presented them with a 2-page typewritten draft of an agreement, and remarked that they were Hitler's final demands, and that the Führer would not permit discussion of them. They must be signed forthwith. Schuschnigg says he felt relieved to have at least something definite from Hitler, but as he perused the document, his relief evaporated. For here was a German ultimatum calling on him, in effect, to turn the Austrian government over to the Nazis within 1 week. The ban against the Austrian Nazi Party was to be lifted, all Nazis in jail were to be amnestied, and the pro-Nazi Viennese lawyer Dr. Seyss-Inquart was to be made Minister of the Interior, with authority over the police and security. Another pro-Nazi, Gleiser Horstenau, was to be appointed Minister of War, and the Austrian and German armies were to establish closer relations by a number of measures, including the systematic exchange of 100 officers. "Preparations will be made," the final demand read, "for the assimilation of the Austrian into the German economic system. For this purpose, Dr. Fischberg, a pro-Nazi, will be appointed Minister of Finance." Schuschnigg, as he later wrote, realized at once that to accept the ultimatum would mean the end of Austria's independence. "Ribbentrop advised me to accept the demands at once. I protested and referred him to my previous agreement with von Papen, made prior to coming to Berchtesgaden, and made clear to Ribbentrop that I was not prepared to be confronted with such unreasonable demands." But was Schuschnigg prepared to accept them? That he was not prepared to be confronted with them was obvious even to a dullard such as Ribbentrop. The question was, would he sign them? In this difficult and decisive moment, the young Austrian chancellor began to weaken. He inquired lamely, according to his own account, whether we could count on the goodwill of Germany, whether the Reich government had at least the intention to keep its side of the bargain. He says he received an answer in the affirmative. Then Papin went to work on him. The slippery ambassador admits to his amazement when he read the ultimatum. It was an unwarrantable interference in Austrian sovereignty. Schuschnigg says Papin apologized to him and expressed his complete surprise at the terms. Nevertheless, he advised the Austrian chancellor to sign them. He further informed me that I could be assured that Hitler would take care that, if I signed and acceded to these demands, from that time on Germany would remain loyal to this agreement, and that there would be no further difficulties for Austria. Schuschnigg, it would appear from the above statements, the last given in an affidavit at Nuremberg, was not only weakening but letting his naivete get the best of him. He had one last chance to make a stand. He was summoned again to Hitler. He found the Führer pacing excitedly up and down in his study. Hitler: Herr Schuschnigg, here is the draft of the document. There is nothing to be discussed. I will not change one single iota. You will either sign it as it is and fulfill my demands within 3 days, or I will order the march into Austria. Schuschnigg capitulated. He told Hitler he was willing to sign, but he reminded him that under the Austrian constitution, only the President of the Republic had the legal power to accept such an agreement and carry it out. Therefore, while he was willing to appeal to the President to accept it, he could give no guarantee. "You have to guarantee it!" Hitler shouted. "I could not possibly, Herr Reichskanzler," Schuschnigg says he replied. At this answer, Schuschnigg later recounted, Hitler seemed to lose his self-control. He ran to the doors, opened them, and shouted, "General Keitel!" Then, turning back to me, he said, "I shall have you called later." This was pure bluff, but the harassed Austrian chancellor, who had been made aware of the presence of the generals all day, did not perhaps know it. Papin relates that Keitel told later of how Hitler greeted him with a broad grin when he rushed in and asked for orders. "There are no orders," Hitler chuckled. "I just wanted to have you here." But Schuschnigg and Dr. Schmidt, waiting outside the Führer's study, were impressed. Schmidt whispered that he would not be surprised if the both of them were arrested within the next 5 minutes. 30 minutes later, Schuschnigg was again ushered into the presence of Hitler. "I have decided to change my mind, for the first time in my life," Hitler said. "But I warn you, this is your very last chance. I have given you 3 additional days to carry out the agreement." That was the extent of the German dictator's concessions, and though the wording of the final draft was somewhat softened, the changes, as Schuschnigg later testified, were inconsequential. Schuschnigg signed. It was Austria's death warrant. The behavior of men under duress differs according to their character and is often puzzling. That Schuschnigg, a veteran despite his comparative youth of the rough and tumble of politics which had seen his predecessor murdered by the Nazis, was a brave man, few would doubt. Yet his capitulation to Hitler on February 11, 1938, under the terrible threat of armed attack, has left a residue of unresolved doubts among his fellow countrymen and the observers and historians of this fateful period. Was surrender necessary? Was there no alternative? It would be a rash man who would argue that Britain and France, in view of their subsequent behavior in the face of Hitler's aggressions, might have come to the aid of Austria had Hitler then and there marched in. But up to this moment, Hitler had not yet broken across the German borders, nor had he prepared his own people and the world for any such act of wanton aggression. The German army itself was scarcely prepared for a war should France and Britain intervene. In a few weeks, Austria, as a result of the Berchtesgaden Agreement, would be softened up by the local Nazis and German machinations to a point where Hitler could take it with much less risk of foreign intervention than on February 11th. Schuschnigg himself, as he later wrote, recognized that acceptance of Hitler's terms meant nothing else but the complete end of the independence of the Austrian government. Perhaps he was in a daze from his ordeal. After signing away his country's independence at the point of a gun, he indulged in a strange conversation with Hitler, which he himself later recorded in his book. "Does the Herr Reichskanzler," he asked, "believe that the various crises in the world today can be solved in a peaceful manner?" The Führer answered fatuously that they could, "if my advice were followed," whereupon Schuschnigg said, apparently with no sign of sarcasm, "at the moment the state of the world looks rather promising, don't you think?" Such an utterance at such a moment seems incredible, but that is what the beaten Austrian chancellor says he said. Hitler had one more humiliation to administer to him. When Schuschnigg suggested that in the press release of their meeting mention be made that their discussion reaffirmed the July 1936 agreement, Hitler exclaimed, "Oh no! First you have to fulfill the conditions of our agreement. This is what is going to the press. Today the Führer and Reich Chancellor conferred with the Austrian Bundeskanzler at the Berghof. That's all." Declining the Führer's invitation to stay for dinner, Schuschnigg and Schmidt drove down from the mountains to Salzburg. It was a gray and foggy winter night. The ubiquitous Papen accompanied them as far as the frontier, and was somewhat uncomfortable in what he terms the oppressive silence. He could not refrain from trying to cheer his Austrian friends up. "Well now," he exclaimed to them, "you have seen what the Führer can be like at times, but the next time I am sure it will be different. You know, the Führer can be absolutely charming." Papen's version, see his memoirs, page 420, is somewhat different, but that of Schuschnigg rings more true. The 4 weeks' agony, February 12th to March 11th, 1938. Hitler had given Schuschnigg 4 days until Tuesday, February 15th, to send him a binding reply that he would carry out the ultimatum, and an additional 3 days until February 18th to fulfill its specific terms. Schuschnigg returned to Vienna on the morning of February 12th and immediately sought out President Miklas. Wilhelm Miklas was a plodding, mediocre man of whom the Viennese said that his chief accomplishment in life had been to father a large brood of children. But there was in him a certain peasant solidity, and in this crisis at the end of 52 years as a state official, he was to display more courage than any other Austrian. He was willing to make certain concessions to Hitler, such as amnestying the Austrian Nazis, but he balked at putting Zeiss Indquart in charge of the police and the army. Papen duly reported this to Berlin on the evening of February 14th. He said Schuschnigg hoped to overcome the resistance of the president by tomorrow. At 7:30 that same evening, Hitler approved orders drawn up by General Keitel to put military pressure on Austria. Spread false but quite credible news, which may lead to the conclusion of military preparations against Austria. As a matter of fact, Schuschnigg had hardly departed from Berchtesgaden when the Führer began shamming military action in order to see that the Austrian Chancellor did as he was told. Jodl jotted it all down in his diary. February 13th. In the afternoon, General Keitel asks Admiral Canaris and myself to come to his apartment. Wilhelm Canaris was head of the Intelligence Bureau, Abwehr, of OKW. He tells us that the Führer's order is that military pressure by shamming military action should be kept up until the 15th. Proposals for these measures are drafted and submitted to the Führer by telephone for approval. February 14th. The effect is quick and strong. In Austria, the impression is created that Germany is undertaking serious military preparations. General Jodl was not exaggerating. Before the threat of armed invasion, President Miklas gave in, and on the last day of grace, February 15th, Schuschnigg formally advised Ambassador von Papen that the Berchtesgaden Agreement would be carried out before February 18th. On February 16th, the Austrian government announced a general amnesty for Nazis, including those convicted in the murder of Dollfuss, and made public the reorganized cabinet, in which Arthur Zeiss Inquart was named Minister of Security. The next day, this Nazi minister hurried off to Berlin to see Hitler and receive his orders. Zeiss Inquart, the first of the Quislings, was a pleasant-mannered, intelligent young Viennese lawyer who since 1918 had been possessed with a burning desire to see Austria joined with Germany. This was a popular notion in the first years after the war. Indeed, on November 12, 1918, the day after the armistice, the Provisional National Assembly in Vienna, which had just overthrown the Habsburg monarchy and proclaimed the Austrian Republic, had tried to effect an Anschluss by affirming that German Austria is a component part of the German Republic. The victorious Allies had not allowed it, and by the time Hitler came to power in 1933, there was no doubt that the majority of Austrians were against their little countries joining with Nazi Germany. But to Zeiss Inquart, as he said at his trial in Nuremberg, The Nazis stood unflinchingly for the Anschluss, and for this reason he gave them his support. He did not join the party and took no part in its rowdy excesses. He played the role rather of a respectable front for the Austrian Nazis, and after the July 1936 agreement, when he was appointed state councillor, he concentrated his efforts, aided by Papen and other German officials and agents, in burrowing from within. Strangely, both Schuschnigg and Miklas seemed to have trusted him almost to the end. Later, Miklas, a devout Catholic, as was Schuschnigg, confessed that he was favorably impressed by the fact that Zeiss was a diligent churchgoer. The man's Catholicism, and also the circumstance that he, like Schuschnigg, had served in a Tyrolean Kaiserjäger regiment during the First World War, in which he was severely wounded, seems to have been the basis of the trust which the Austrian Chancellor had for him. Schuschnigg, unfortunately, had a fatal inability to judge a man on more substantial grounds. Perhaps he thought he could keep his new Nazi minister in line by simple bribes. He himself tells in his book of the magic effect of $500 on Zeiss Inquart a year before when he threatened to resign as state councillor, and then reconsidered on the receipt of this paltry sum. But Hitler had the bigger prizes to dazzle before the ambitious young lawyer, as Schuschnigg was soon to learn. On February 20th, Hitler made his long-expected speech to the Reichstag, which had been postponed from January 30th because of the Blomberg-Fritsch crisis and his own machinations against Austria. Though he spoke warmly of Schuschnigg's understanding and of his warm-hearted willingness to bring about a closer understanding between Austria and Germany, a piece of humbug which impressed Prime Minister Chamberlain, the Führer issued a warning which, however much lost on London, did not fall upon deaf ears in Vienna and in Prague. Over 10 million Germans live in two of the states adjoining our frontiers. There must be no doubt about one thing. Political separation from the Reich may not lead to deprivation of rights. That is, the general rights of self-determination. It is unbearable for a world power to know there are racial comrades at its side who are constantly being afflicted with the severest suffering for their sympathy or unity with the whole nation, its destiny and its Weltanschauung. To the interests of the German Reich belong the protection of those German peoples who are not in a position to secure along our frontiers their political and spiritual freedom by their own efforts. That was blunt public notice that henceforth Hitler regarded the future of the 7 million Austrians and the 3 million Sudeten Germans in Czechoslovakia as the affair of the Third Reich. Schuschnigg answered Hitler 4 days later, on February 24th, in a speech to the Austrian Bundestag, whose members, like those of the German Reichstag, were hand-picked by a one-party dictatorial regime. Though conciliatory toward Germany, Schuschnigg emphasized that Austria had gone to the very limit of concessions, where we must call a halt and say, thus far and no further. Austria, he said, would never voluntarily give up its independence, and he ended with a stirring call. Red, white, red, the Austrian national colors, until we're dead. The expression also rhymes in German. The 24th of February, Schuschnigg wrote after the war, was for me the crucial date. He awaited anxiously the Führer's reaction to his defiant speech. Papen telegraphed to Berlin the next day, advising the Foreign Office that the speech should not be taken too seriously. Schuschnigg, he said, had expressed his rather strong nationalist feelings in order to retrieve his domestic position. There were plots in Vienna to overthrow him because of his concessions at Berchtesgaden. In the meantime, Papen informed Berlin, the work of Zeiss Inquart is proceeding according to plan. The next day, Papen, his long years of devious work in Austria nearing fruition, took formal leave of the Austrian Chancellor and set off for Kitzbühel to do some skiing. Hitler's speech of February 20th, which had been broadcast by the Austrian radio network, had set off a series of massive Nazi demonstrations throughout Austria. On February 24th, during the broadcast of Schuschnigg's reply, a wild mob of 20,000 Nazis in Graz had invaded the town square, torn down the loudspeakers, hauled down the Austrian flag, and raised the swastika banner of Germany. With Zeiss Inquart in personal command of the police, no effort was made to curb the Nazi outbreaks. Schuschnigg's government was breaking down. Not only political, but economic chaos was setting in. There were large withdrawals of accounts from the banks, both from abroad and by the local people. Cancellation of orders from uneasy foreign firms poured into Vienna. The foreign tourists, one of the main props of the Austrian economy, were being frightened away. Toscanini cabled from New York that he was cancelling his appearance at the Salzburg Festival, which drew tens of thousands of tourists each summer, because of political developments in Austria. The situation was becoming so desperate that Otto of Habsburg, the exiled youthful pretender to the throne, sent a letter from his home in Belgium, and, as Schuschnigg later revealed, implored him on his old oath of allegiance as a former officer of the Imperial Army to appoint him as chancellor if he thought such a step might save Austria. In his desperation, Schuschnigg turned to the Austrian workers, whose free trade unions and political party, the Social Democrats, he had kept suppressed after Dollfuss had brutally smashed them in 1934. These people had represented 42% of the Austrian electorate, and if at any time during the past 4 years the Chancellor had been able to see beyond the narrow horizons of his own clerical fascist dictatorship and had enlisted their support for a moderate anti-Nazi democratic coalition, the Nazis, a relatively small minority, could have been easily handled. But Schuschnigg had lacked the stature to take such a step. A decent, upright man as a human being, he had become possessed, as had certain others in Europe, with a contempt for Western democracy and a passion for authoritarian one-party rule. Out of the factories and the prisons, from which many of them recently had been released along with the Nazis, the Social Democrats came in a body on March 4th to respond to the Chancellor's call. Despite all that had happened, they said they were ready to help the government defend the nation's independence. All they asked was what the Chancellor had already conceded to the Nazis: the right to have their own political party and preach their own principles. Schuschnigg agreed, but it was too late. On March 3rd, the always well-informed General Jodl noted in his diary, "The Austrian question is becoming critical. 100 officers shall be dispatched here. The Führer wants to see them personally. They should not see to it that the Austrian armed forces will fight better against us, but rather that they do not fight at all." At this crucial moment, Schuschnigg decided to make one more final desperate move which he had been mulling over in his mind since the last days of February when the Nazis began to take over in the provinces. He would hold a plebiscite. He would ask the Austrian people whether they were for a free, independent, social, Christian, and united Austria. Ja oder nein? According to the testimony of President Miklas during a trial of an Austrian Nazi in Vienna after the war, the plebiscite was suggested to Schuschnigg by France. Papen, in his memoirs, suggests that the French minister in Vienna, Monsieur Pau, a close personal friend of the Chancellor, was the father of the plebiscite idea. He concedes, however, that Schuschnigg certainly adopted it on his own responsibility. "I felt that the moment for a clear decision had come," Schuschnigg later wrote. "It seemed irresponsible to wait with fettered hands until, in the course of some weeks, we should be gagged as well. The gamble now was for stakes which demanded the ultimate and supreme effort." Shortly after his return from Berchtesgaden, Schuschnigg had apprised Mussolini, Austria's protector, of Hitler's threats and had received an immediate reply from the Duce that Italy's position on Austria remained unchanged. Now, on March 7th, he sent his military attaché in Rome to Mussolini to inform him that, in view of events, he was probably going to have to resort to a plebiscite. The Italian dictator answered that it was a mistake. Se un errore. He advised Schuschnigg to hold to his previous course. Things were improving. An impending relaxation of relations between Rome and London would do much to ease the pressure. It was the last Schuschnigg ever heard from Mussolini. On the evening of March 9th, Schuschnigg announced in a speech at Innsbruck that a plebiscite would be held in 4 days, on Sunday, March 13th. The unexpected news sent Adolf Hitler into a fit of fury. Jodl's diary entry of March 10th described the initial reaction in Berlin. By surprise and without consulting his ministers, Schuschnigg ordered a plebiscite for Sunday, March 13th. Führer is determined not to tolerate it. The same night, March 9th to 10th, he calls for Göring. General von Reichenau is called back from Cairo Olympic Committee. General von Schobert, commander of the Munich military district on the Austrian border, is ordered to come, as well as Austrian Minister Gleiser Horstenau, who is in the Palatinate. Ribbentrop is being detained in London. Neurath takes over the Foreign Office. The next day, Thursday, March 10th, there was a great bustle in Berlin. Hitler had decided on a military occupation of Austria, and there is no doubt that his generals were taken by surprise. If Schuschnigg's plebiscite on Sunday were to be prevented by force, the army would have to move into Austria by Saturday, and there were no plans for such a hasty move. Hitler summoned Keitel for 10 a.m., but before hurrying to the Führer, the general conferred with Jodl and General Max von Wieban, chief of the Führungsstab, operations staff of OKW. The resourceful Jodl remembered Special Case Otto, which had been drawn up to counter an attempt to place Otto of Habsburg on the Austrian throne. Since it was the only plan that existed for military action against Austria, Hitler decided it would have to do. "Prepare Case Otto," he ordered. Keitel raced back to OKW headquarters in the Bendlerstrasse to confer with General Beck, chief of the general staff. When he asked for details of the Otto plan, Beck replied, "We have prepared nothing. Nothing has been done, nothing at all." Beck, in turn, was summoned to the Reich Chancellery. Seizing General von Manstein, who was about to leave Berlin to take up a divisional post, he drove with him over to see Hitler, who told them the army must be ready to march into Austria by Saturday. Neither of the generals offered any objection to this proposal for armed aggression. They were merely concerned with the difficulty of improvising military action on such short notice. Manstein, returning to the Bendlerstrasse, set to work to draft the necessary orders, finishing his task within 5 hours at 6 p.m. At 6:30 p.m., according to Jodl's diary, mobilization orders went out to 3 Army Corps and the Air Force. At 2 a.m. the next morning, March 11th, Hitler issued Directive No. 1 for Operation Otto. Such was his haste that he neglected to sign it, and his signature was not obtained until 1 p.m. Top Secret. 1. If other measures prove unsuccessful, I intend to invade Austria with armed forces to establish constitutional conditions and to prevent further outrages against the pro-German population. 2. The whole operation will be directed by myself. 4. The forces of the Army and the Air Force detailed for this operation must be ready for invasion on March 12, 1938, at the latest by 1200 hours. 5. The behavior of the troops must give the impression that we do not want to wage war against our Austrian brothers. Therefore, any provocation is to be avoided. If, however, resistance is offered, it must be broken ruthlessly by force of arms. A few hours later, Jodl issued supplemental top-secret orders on behalf of the Chief of the Supreme Command of the Armed Forces. 1. If Czechoslovakian troops or militia units are encountered in Austria, they are to be regarded as hostile. 2. The Italians are everywhere to be treated as friends, especially as Mussolini has declared himself disinterested in the solution of the Austrian question. Hitler had been worried about Mussolini. On the afternoon of March 10th, as soon as he had decided on military invasion, he had sent off by special plane Prince Philip of Hesse with a letter to the Duce, dated March 11th, informing him of the action he contemplated and asking for the Italian dictator's understanding. The letter, a tissue of lies concerning his treatment of Schuschnigg and conditions in Austria, which he assured the Duce were approaching a state of anarchy, began with such a fraudulent argument that Hitler had it omitted when the letter was later published in Germany. The stricken passages were found after the war in the archives of the Italian Foreign Ministry. He stated that Austria and Czechoslovakia were plotting to restore the Habsburgs and preparing to throw the weight of a mass of at least 20 million men against Germany. He then outlined his demands to Schuschnigg, which, he assured Mussolini, were more than moderate, told of Schuschnigg's failure to carry them out, and spoke of the mockery of a so-called plebiscite. "In my responsibility as Führer and Chancellor of the German Reich, and likewise as a son of this soil, I can no longer remain passive in the face of these developments. I am now determined to restore law and order in my homeland and enable the people to decide their own fate according to their judgment in an unmistakable, clear, and open manner. Whatever the manner may be in which this plebiscite is to be carried out, I now wish solemnly to assure Your Excellency, as the Duce of Fascist Italy, 1. Consider this step only as one of national self-defense, and therefore is an act that any man of character would do in the same way, were he in my position. You too, Excellency, could not act differently if the fate of Italians were at stake. Two, in a critical hour for Italy, I proved to you the steadfastness of my sympathy. Do not doubt that in the future there will be no change in this respect. Three, whatever the consequences of the coming events may be, I have drawn a definite boundary between Germany and France, and now draw one just as definite between Italy and us. It is the Brenner. Always in friendship, yours, Adolf Hitler. Drawing the frontier at the Brenner was a sop to Mussolini. It meant that Hitler would not be asking for the return of the southern Tyrol, which was taken from Austria and awarded to Italy at Versailles.